Well, it was just about a year ago. I was sitting one Saturday with our youth leaders back in Ireland. It was a whole day seminar called Walk Through the Bible, aimed at equipping leaders to tell the whole sweep of the Bible narrative using hand signs and gestures. And all was going well. We were learning different words and different hand signs. But down the list, I saw the word transfiguration. And I thought to myself, I wonder what hand sign we're going to do for transfiguration. And so the moment came, and the instructor said to us, I want you to imagine you're a charismatic preacher, which was quite a stretch for some of us. And he did this. With your jazz hands, do it this way. Transfiguration! You needed to see that in the whole course. And it was so flash, and do you know what? It just didn't feel right. It just didn't feel right. Because how do you summarize transfiguration? So today the question I want you to mull over in your own mind is, how do I respond to the transfiguration? I think in this story, there's one unhelpful way to respond, and there's one helpful way to respond to the transfiguration. Because this is a scene that holds a lot in tension. There's this temporal world. You have Peter, James, and John up in the mountain, and it's temporal. But being broken into is this whole other eternal world. And you have Moses and Elijah, the voice from heaven. And somehow Jesus is straddling both these worlds in a way we can't fully grasp. At the moment in this snowy March in Grand Rapids, I'm imagining another world in Ireland, the March there where there's green fields and lambs being born and daffodils. But it's so hard to hold these two worlds together. It's only a fleeting memory. But transfiguration is the place of tensions. You've the ascent, you've the descent. You've this sense of knowing God, and yet the cloud of unknowing. You've the revelation, pulling back the curtain, and no sooner has the curtain been pulled back, Jesus is alone again. And so much of this parallels the other story that we had in Exodus. That story of Moses on the mountain, where he meets God in the thick darkness of a cloud. He saw no shape of God that day, but he hears God's plan of how his people should live in a beloved community. And then that mysterious moment where Moses sees God's back. It's so mysterious. But there's no doubt that Moses encountered God because his face, too, is shining. Transfiguration. Like Moses, Jesus, he also goes up on a mountain with his three companions. Like Moses, Jesus hears this voice from the cloud. Like Moses, he has this shining appearance. But up until this moment, the disciples are really struggling to keep a pace with Jesus on this journey of discovery. They're trying to figure out, who is this Jesus? Is he like Elijah? Will he be like Moses and find a new community? Where do we locate this Jesus? And in the midst of these slow realizations, you have to admit, these disciples are struggling. There's a sleepy quality to these disciples. It feels like hard work for the disciples. Yes, they're tagging along, but most of the times they're barely available to God and to Jesus. Now, Jesus had already said that the pathway to true liberation will be this lonely pathway of suffering. And that's not welcome news to the disciples. And so even on the mountaintop, even though there's flashes of lightning, it says the disciples are sleepy. Now, have you ever slept through a lightning storm? It's quite unbelievable. Here are the disciples, so somnolent, even though Jesus' garments are flashing like lightning. They're missing out on the fact that in this moment, past and present and future are all being brought together in Jesus. Because this is the pivotal moment. This is the last epiphany before Jesus sets his face towards Jerusalem. And it's so satirical, this contrast. The sleepy disciples who in a moment will go back to arguing about who will be the greatest. You have that contrast it with the Son of Man who's going to come down and sink lower into his humiliating betrayal. To say that the disciples had their heads in the clouds, that's just the understatement. So at this human, worldly level, you have the disciples struggling. It's not going well for them. But then you have the eternal world moving in parallel beside it. All the heavyweights are being brought in. Moses, the representative lawgiver, he's there. Elijah, the representative prophet, he's there. And God himself adds his voice, this triumvirate of endorsement. And their message is one and the same. Let's talk about Jesus' departure. Or if you want to use the Greek, let's talk about Exodus. Let's talk about Exodus. Let's talk about what it is to liberate people from slavery. In the same way the people were called out of Egypt to become a new community and move to the promised land, let's talk about how Jesus is going to do that. How he's going to set people free and break open death to bring a new pathway that will bring these worlds together again, heaven and earth. And these three figures step in to affirm this divine disclosure that Jesus is the one to bring this exodus about, to bring liberation about through death on the cross. And the one disciple who's beginning to get an acknowledgement of what's going on here is Peter. And he says those words, "Master, it's just good for us to be here. So let's build three shelters for you and for Moses and Elijah." And it's easy to deny Peter a bit of ground here by judging this reaction to stay on the mountaintop. But you know what? I think Peter is only doing what we would have done in that situation. When faced with an unsettling epiphany, we all try to fit this experience into the understanding of God we already have. That's what Peter was doing here. He was building shelters, a very Jewish thing to be about. It was also very appropriate because it originated way back in Genesis 33, that moment when Jacob was moving towards the promised land after years of slavery with his uncle Laban. He sees Esau, his enemy, but in him he has this epiphany because he sees the face of God and he builds a shelter because he's been set free from slavery. His enemies have been disappeared and he's encountered God. He builds a shelter. And so years later, when they're liberated from Egypt, they too experience freedom. And as they journey to their promised land, they too build shelters as they encounter the living God in cloud and in fire. Building shelters. Peter's response to the God who liberates, it's measured, it's appropriate. You could say, well, this is a beautiful piece of Jewish liturgy. It makes sense. Liturgical scholars would be so proud of this symbolic response. However, all three Gospels follow this story with something interesting. After the Transfiguration, the disciples come down off the mountain, and the next day a man approaches Jesus with his son. "Teacher, I beg you, look at my child. There are demons in him. An evil spirit has seized him. He's foaming at the mouth. The spirit is trying to destroy him. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they couldn't." There it is. That's the rub here. Because Peter has been constructing this liturgy, talking about setting people free, living up on this glorious mountain, when in the next moment, when they encounter someone who needs to be set free, it says the disciples weren't up to the task. They're unable to do anything about it. And you see, the challenge is Peter had crafted a God who was too small, who fit it neatly into his Jewish congruent way of thinking, but a God who couldn't change the world. That was the problem. Peter shaped God into his life instead of allowing himself to be shaped into God's life, the bigger picture of transformation for the whole cosmos. And that's the problem in our worship. We expect God to come into our shelter, to endorse our cause, to fit our expectations and our institutions and our traditions. And in the end, we create a God who's neither living or divine. And we come down off the mountain and we face what? We face a golden calf. If our worship does not lead to transformation, what is it worth? What is it worth? If we can't follow Jesus into the valley and see him defeat the enemy and set the captives free, we've built our shelters too small, in a place too high and too far away. This week, some of you went to listen to Mary Cohen talk about music making in prison. She's doing a wonderful thing. In 2009, she established Oakdale Prison Community Choir, comprising of inmates, but also men and women from the outside, people from two very different worlds. And as she described her artwork, she cautioned against a beauty in artwork that dazzles but does not change the narrative. It's not right to keep busy singing when the important work is to dismantle corrupt, inhumane systems. Focusing on only putting a pretty veneer on a rotten system is like scaffolding a house of cards. It's building shelters. And too often that's what we settle for, isn't it? We build our shelters. When our kingdom calling is to press in where there's brokenness in this world, and to say, this is not how it should be. We want transformation. Too often we sing of Christ's transcendence as a way of keeping ourselves pure and undefiled in the world, when all the while Jesus is to be found drawing near to those who are tortured in their own minds. That's where we need to be. One outcome of living in a sectarian culture in Ireland is to notice how it affects our hymnody. And we love to sing about transcendence, crown him with many crowns, immortal, invisible, God only wise, holy, holy, holy. But I remember the time we tried to sing a John Bell song about the incarnation, where Christ draws near to the hurting, where Christ sits with the man who is unemployed. And one of our members got upset and said, "You are shaming the unemployed." And they missed the point, building shelters. Sometimes we get so caught up in our building in the limelight, we forget that the most important work happens in the dark. It's better to start in the valley and see the mountaintop. It's better to start in the dark places and get disturbed that these are not the way things should be, and catch a glimpse of transformational glory. It's better to follow Martin Luther King, who in the midst of the darkness of the deeply divided society in which he lived, was able to say, "I've been to the mountaintop, so I'm happy tonight. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." It's better to know that there is a place where demons shriek and sufferers weep, where the Son of Man will be handed over to sinners, because we know this darkness will not overcome Christ's eternal light. You see, if transfiguration is all we're ever going to get, would it have been enough? Would it have been enough to know God's love? Because even in this glory moment, there was hiddenness, brilliance for a moment, and then the cloud overshadowing them. And there are moments in life where we're all feeling that way, like the psalmist. "How long, O Lord, will you hide your face from me?" We sing, "Holy, holy, holy, though the darkness hide thee, though the eye of sinful man thy glory may not see." But it's in these moments we have an answer, because we set our faces like Elijah and Moses did to think of Exodus. We think about Jesus' departure, because that's where love is made known. That's where love is made visible. That the glory they had glimpsed on this mountain, the glory of God's chosen Son, would finally be unveiled on a different hill, this ugly little hill outside Jerusalem, where glory would kiss in gloriousness, where the rational world of God would meet this irrational world, that the Eternal One should die, where continuity and discontinuity connect in ways that are mysteries. But it was out of a deep love for us, a love that allowed nails to be put in his hands. God left us in no doubt of his love by giving himself utterly to us. So if building shelters is not the right response for us today, what is the right response? God simply tells us in this passage. He says, "Listen to him. Listen to my Son, the one whom I love." Because it's only when we listen to God we realize who Jesus is, that he is not like Elijah, and he's not like a good man Moses. This is the chosen one. This is the Son of God who can break open the enemy of death so that we can find shelter in him, so that we can be transfigured into his likeness through listening to him, through growing to be more like him. Listen to him. Paul says it this way: "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom." And we who with unveiled faces will reflect the Lord's glory, we're being transfigured into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. If we listen to God, we will become like him, and we will see his likeness in others. How do we respond? Listen to him. So this morning, there are three different types of people this story might connect to. First of all, there's those disciples who are so busy with life, they've made themselves unavailable to God. Maybe even busy working for God, but not available to him. Listen to him. Then there are those like Peter, beginning to to understand what Christ is calling you to do, that there is such a thing as necessary suffering in the pathway of discipleship, but that's scary. That's overwhelming when you think of how much bigger God is and how much it might cost you, and so you begin to get busy with the work of your hands and your projects. Maybe God is calling you to trust in his sheltering power, to simply follow and see his work, the work of his nail-scarred hands. And the final person is the one who feels they've never reached the mountaintop, never seen anything spectacular, and all that stares them in the face is the valley, the challenges of life. Well, I want to say Christ didn't stay on that mountaintop. He came down for you. He came down for you because he wanted to show the full extent of his love. We don't need to build shelters, because the story of the cross is that in the darkest hour, when the temple of the curtain, that shelter was torn in two, Jesus was finding a way to shelter us all. We have a shelter in God. And we can say like the psalmist, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge. He is my fortress, my God in whom I trust. He will save you from the fowler's snare and from deadly pestilence. Under his wings you will find shelter. If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord, no harm will befall you. No disaster will come near your shelter. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. He will call on me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation.